Don't you wish your life came with a warning app?
That dog does not want to be petted.
Well, life doesn't always give you time to change the outcome, but prediabetes does. Take the one-minute test today at doihaveprediabetes.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council and its Prediabetes Awareness Partners.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Donald Trump kicks off his campaign for a second term as president of the United States with a raucous rally of some 20,000 supporters in Orlando, Florida. What's his case for re-election, and where does he stand 16 months before Election Day in 2020? Welcome. I'm Paul Gigot with my two esteemed colleagues, Kyle Peterson. Hello, Kyle.
Hello, hello.
And Kimberly Strassel. Hey, Kim.
Hey, Paul.
So the Trump event, 78 minutes of his talking, hour and a half if you were watching the intros and the rest of it. It was a typical, I guess, by now, if somewhat a larger event for Trump, a lot like the rallies he normally conducts. But it was billed as the kickoff of his reelection campaign. So at least as of now, any doubts about whether Donald Trump will run for a second term seem to have ended. Have to sort of think that this was the start of his case for why he should be elected. Kim, what struck you about the remarks? Anything new, different, notable?
The one thing that really stood out for me was the beginning of the speech, in which he decided that he was not going to make this about Donald Trump. He was going to make it about the people, as it were. He was saying a lot of lines saying, you know, they want to stop us. This has been a government by the people and for the people. And those who oppose my reelection are opposing you. He also suggested that a lot of the backlash was, in fact, about his agenda rather than about him personally. And this, I would wager, might be a nod to the fact that the polling does show that Donald Trump does have issues, again, with a lot of those suburban women, and they have issues with his personality and him as a person. And so this seems to be an attempt to change that focus, suggest that everything that's happened over the last couple of years is instead a backlash to an agenda that is working.
I guess two things, Paul, struck me. The first is just how consummate of a performer Donald Trump is. I mean, in his usual style, he was walking the stage and basking in the crowd's adulation. He had some funny lines. He was talking again about Hillary Clinton's emails, and he said, you know, if I deleted one email like a love note to Melania, it's the electric chair for Trump. You know, that's kind of a funny line. He did an applause meter at one point, asking the crowd to cheer whether they wanted his slogan to be "Make America Great Again" still, or "Keep America Great." And then the second thing that struck me was that he seems like he's geared up to run against Democratic extremism. So he called the Democratic Party dangerous, unhinged, afflicted with an ideological sickness. He said a vote for any Democrat in 2020 is a vote for the rise of socialism. He talked about crazy Bernie's socialist takeover of healthcare. He talked about taxpayer funding of abortion. And the question is whether this will appeal beyond his base. So the line of the night that encapsulated it for me was Trump said, quote, "Our political opponents look down with hatred on our values and with utter disdain for the people whose lives they want to run." I mean, that is obviously a message that resonates with his fans. I don't know how well it will resonate in the suburbs or beyond his base.
Yeah, for those of us who remember Ronald Reagan and his pitch for a second term in 1984, this is not going to be a Morning in America campaign. I mean, Trump is going to hit upon his successes. For sure, an attempt to say, this is my record and here's why we have succeeded. But it is going to be a campaign of dividing, of creating sharp divisions between himself and the Democrats. He's going to say, look, the Democrats are going to take you off the cliff here, 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 and here. And this is on these issues. And here's why I'm not going to, we can't let them do that. And I think that's in part a testimony to the polarized times we're living through. Both parties are more polarized ideologically than ever. They're more polarized on culture than ever. So Trump, while recognizing his economic, he's going to say, look, I have helped the economy. My policies have worked economically. He's going to mention that and then move into these divisions on a whole host of cultural and other ideological issues, Kim.
Well, and I think that that is the approach that you take if you are a Trump team that looks out at those polling numbers and you recognize that, you know, Trump is never going to be get a 60% approval rating in terms of personality, right?
Well, he'd settle for 50, I think.
he would. He's not a light and airy guy, you know, and he's got a lot of critics out there. So how do you overcome that, especially when, you know, you have a candidate that is not going to change his personality in that regard? You seek to make the other side have even lower approval ratings than you do, and you warn about what they're going to do. The most striking line to me in that entire speech, because I do think it's one that will resonate not just with the base, but potentially to some of those middle of the road voters, was this one. He said, "This election is a verdict on whether we want to live in a country where the people who lose an election refuse to concede and spend the next 2 years trying to shred our Constitution and rip your country apart." And that is Trump suggesting that if Democrats obtain power, that, you know, they're going to, it's a little bit, it reminded me of Lindsey Graham at the end of those Kavanaugh hearings saying, "Boy, do you guys want power, and I hope you never get it." And so he's seeking to present all of the strife and that division of the last couple of years, the polarization that you mentioned, as at the feet of Democrats. We'll see if that's enough, though, because the one other thing that really struck me from the speech is how he didn't have much of an agenda for a second term.
Yeah, I want to get into that. But on your point about the mentioning that the Democrats who refuse to accept the legitimacy of his election, I mean, I think that that is, he has a justifiable point there, but it also suggests a potential problem. And the justifiable point is that, in fact, there are much of the media and the Democrats have not accepted the legitimacy of his election. They still believe it was tainted. They still believe he won because of Russia, or like to think so, not because of they nominated Hillary Clinton, who was less acceptable than Donald Trump. So he has a legitimate point there, I think, it's where that he can make. On the other hand, it's backward looking. I mean, he's basically saying to the electorate, let's refight the battle of 2016. And while that might be satisfying to a chunk of his core supporters, for most Americans, the 2020 election for them is, well, what about the next four? What is it that you're going to do for me in the next 4 years? And to look back on and say Hillary's emails, the Robert Mueller campaign, the Steele dossier, or whatever you want to make, however you want to revisit all of those issues from the 2016 campaign, I think for many voters in the middle, or many voters who haven't been paying attention to this conflict in Washington, they'll say, "What? You won. You're in the Oval."
though in Trump's limited defense here, I mean, he doesn't have an opponent yet. He's always felt most comfortable on the attack, and he doesn't have a target yet. You know, so there in his mind, what's he going to do? Go up there and have one section of the speech for each of the 20 candidates that he could potentially be facing? I mean, he's saving that for the Democratic debate next week, which he apparently is going to be live tweeting. But the question of whether this rhetoric works, I think, will depend in large part on who Democrats choose to oppose President Trump. I mean, Bernie Sanders has leaned into the label of socialist. And so if he is the one that gets the nomination, this kind of rhetoric about how, you know, the Dems are extreme and dangerous and unhinged may work. I mean, you may see a 2020 election that turns out to be a grinding test of who is more unlikable, somewhat similar to how the 2016 election was. But if it's somebody who is more of a cipher or more of an unknown in the public mind, I mean, Kamala Harris, I don't know that will work, because she may be able to define herself as more forward-looking, optimistic, you know, or someone who is putting forth policies and looking forward instead of looking back.
All right, we're talking about Donald Trump's launch of his reelection campaign, and you're listening to Potomac Watch from the Wall Street Journal.
Don't you wish your life came with a warning app?
That dog does not want to be petted.
Well, life doesn't always give you time to change the outcome, but prediabetes does. Take the one-minute test today at doihaveprediabetes.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council and its prediabetes awareness partners.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Welcome back. I'm Paul Gigot with Kim Strassel and Kyle Peterson talking about Donald Trump's launch of his campaign for a second term. And let's dig into that point about Trump and his agenda. Now, some people will say, look, it's 16 months to go. You don't need an agenda. There's plenty of time to roll out an agenda. And to some extent, that's true. On the other hand, you really do have to tell people, I think, it's my view, what you're going to do next. Even if you're an incumbent, you can only take, I've done this for you as a campaign theme so far. You need to say, I've done this and I want to do that. And if you think about this in the context, Kim, of Donald Trump's first term, my view is that his successes are related more almost entirely, the main successes, to fulfilling what I would call conventional Republican policies. I'm thinking about tax reform, deregulation, unleashing energy production domestically, which all of which have helped the economy, lifted it up to 3% GDP growth as opposed to 2%, and have improved earnings. You got the judiciary, the judicial picks. Again, a conventional Republican, important conventional Republican policy. You've got the increase in defense spending, again, an issue that unites almost all Republicans. If you think about the things where Trump has failed to fulfill his campaign promises, one of which is healthcare, and that's a complicated issue given the fact that that was a failure as much of Congress as Donald Trump. But it is trade and immigration, where he was the disruptor. That was a distinctive Donald Trump agenda from the traditional Republican agenda. And on those, there hasn't been much success. Not much difference. No deal in Congress on a border wall or a larger immigration bill. And on trade, a lot of disruption, but nothing new that has succeeded.
Yeah, and part of that is because these are issues, in particular immigration, where Republicans remain very divided. And when you have issues like that, you look to a president to unite a party and push things through. And that is truly something Trump has failed to do. Remember, he did have the House for the first 2 years, and they talked about this, but there was no common ground in the end, and Republicans just could not get over that hump. And so I do think there's some danger, and we heard him talk in his speech last night about how he needs a second term so that he can continue to fulfill these promises. And he mentioned the wall, it's getting built, you know, soon, talked about immigration, talked about trade and tariffs. Got to give me time to get these things done. But I think one of the dangers of that is that it reminds people that he didn't get them done. One other thing I would just add, I agree with you that part of this, his success was in traditional Republican promises. Some of it was also that I do think there's a piece of the disruptive Trump that was also key to his election, which was his whole drain the swamp, change Washington business as usual. And, you know, that to me ought to be the one of the grounds on which he tries to build a second term agenda, because it is something that really does seem to resonate with a lot of Americans. And I don't know what that is. Deregulation is part of it, but there are other things, you know, civil service reform or something. But I think that those are prosperity themes, the traditional Republican promises. And then in that, if he could build an agenda on that, then he sounds like he's got a plan for the second term.
Yeah, I agree. There were some pledges of things that he wanted to do, add to his to-do list in his second term.
Yeah, cure cancer and go to Mars. I think that's not going to take.
Right.
It's going to take a little more than 4 years.
Eliminate AIDS in America. And they felt like they were kind of tacked on there at the end of the speech. One place where I do think he was effective was in talking about the problem with the asylum laws. I mean, he's talking about how we need to keep on moving forward with the Trump agenda. And he said, essentially, you know, if we could get some Democratic help, we could solve this. Democrats and Republicans in Congress could get into a room and in 15 minutes, they could solve this problem. And to his credit, he did not say, in my second term, I'm going to sign an executive order, which will do X, Y, and Z, which is what, you know, a lot of politics has turned into.
That's what Barack Obama did.
Well, and if you look at some of the Kamala Harris platform planks, they are, there's a lot of that in there. So I do think he was effective in that. I mean, I wish he would use his bully pulpit more and in places outside of a long campaign speech and make that point and put some real pressure on Democrats to come together. I mean, that would be a way to get an accomplishment that he could, hang his first term on. But I agree that he has sort of seeded the field on some of these policy proposals. Just to take a specific one, housing. I mean, there seems to be a growing consensus that the rent is too darn high, as someone once said, that there's zoning laws that restrict building. As a builder, you would think that Trump would be all over talking about that. And if you look at the Democratic candidates, there are a lot of them that are putting out these proposals to deal with that problem, to help renters. Some of those proposals are not very well designed from a policy standpoint. You're talking about a tax credit for anyone paying 30%. Or more of their income in rent. I'm not sure that's quite the way that we ought to go, but you'd think that Trump would be able to come in and fill the hole, the need for a kind of policy to deal with this problem, and say, this is what I'm going to do in my second term.
Yeah, I was thinking exactly about housing as an area which was ripe for Trump to take it right to the Democrats in these blue cities where you can't afford a house and say, here's why. Let me explain this to you. Here's why you can't do that. I think he did mention education reform, continuing that, but that's one where he can, I think, expand his agenda beyond K through 12 and start talking about technical education and vocational education, and start talking about higher education, skills education for Americans who don't go to the Ivy League or to Stanford, and I think make that a reform a theme. You know, he could package several proposals that this administration is moving forward ahead with rules. With executive orders and rules changes within the Obamacare framework to reduce healthcare prices, and say we're doing this, and if you reelect me for a second term, we can expand on that. That does risk talking about healthcare, which the Democrats want to talk about, but I think at least it gives him some ground to defend on healthcare and not have to fall back and say, well, we couldn't repeal and replace Obamacare. Here's what I would do now, given the fact that that has happened. Kim, I think there's a lot of fruitful areas he could go.
Oh, yeah. He could also go down. Look, another huge one. We talk a lot about infrastructure. But one of the things that really came out of that brief, if you would even call it discussion, that he had with Democrats on that subject is that there's a very clear choice to be made here. Democrats simply want to throw tons of government money at infrastructure. And Trump at times, at least in his executive actions, when he first came in, he signed some executive orders. He's tried to put his finger on the real problem, which is actually one he really understands because of his time in construction, is that you can't do any of this unless you first fix all of your environmental regulations and reviews and all of the barriers and hurdles to getting infrastructure done. And that was supposed to be part of the deal here. You know, you Democrats allow us to, for instance, reform the National Environmental Policy Act, and maybe then we'll put some government money into working with the private sector to do some infrastructure, but we're not going to throw money at things that are projects that are 15 years down the road, if at all. So there's, I think, a lot of things that go to those themes of both prosperity and changing some of the fundamentally broken aspects of U.S. government that he could certainly build on, that I think would be an inspiration to some voters.
All right. Let's turn to Trump's standing as he seeks reelection politically, just to the raw politics. And I'm looking at the head-to-head matchups here, that Donald Trump against the leading Democratic candidates, and he's trailing. This is in the Real Clear Politics polling average. He's trailing Joe Biden by 9. He's trailing Elizabeth Warren by 4. He's trailing Bernie Sanders by 6. He's trailing Kamala Harris by 3, and he's even trailing Pete Buttigieg by two. So he's trailing them all at this stage. And his approval rating, of course, overall is well below 45%. That begs the question, Kyle. I mean, how is Donald Trump a favorite, or is he at this stage an underdog for reelection?
Well, I think it's an uphill climb. I mean, one advantage of selling some policies and having a more sunny outlook on his part would be to reach out beyond his base. Don't forget that the Republicans lost the House in 2018, and they lost it primarily among suburban voters. I mean, they lost seats in suburban Chicago. They lost seats in suburban Dallas. And the fundamental fact of 2016, you also can't forget, is that Donald Trump lost the popular vote by almost 3 million ballots. And so the Democratic nominee in 2020 doesn't even need to do better than that. He or she just needs to move some of these people a few ways across state borders to pick up Michigan, to pick up Wisconsin. And if you look at Trump's approval in some of these key swing states, it's not very good. I mean, the Morning Consult poll, North Carolina and Ohio, he's underwater by 4 points. Pennsylvania, he's underwater by 7 points. Michigan, it's 12 points. Wisconsin, it's 13 points. And so the question becomes, if he's going to win the Electoral College, how he goes about turning that around in the next 18 months.
There's a paradox, Kim, in these polling numbers. And I take the point of the Trump supporters who said, look, it's early at this stage in their first terms. Bill Clinton was going to lose. Barack Obama was going to lose. Ronald Reagan was behind and trailing Walter Mondale in June of the year before his reelection year. So obviously things can change enormously. But the paradox I would point to is Donald Trump has an economy that the public gives him above 50% credit for. So he's doing well by his economic management. You have a strong economy, and yet Trump can't parlay that into a higher approval rating. And that suggests that there's some other reasons for his low approval.
Yeah, the approval ratings should be more concerning to the White House and to those watching than these head-to-head matchups. I don't have a lot of time for these head-to-head matchups at this point because it's too vague of an actual contest. Voters are not focused at the moment, and you know, the idea of trying to decide between Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump now just doesn't make a lot of sense. But the approval ratings should be more concerning, in particular in those swing states that Kyle mentioned, and in particular because, as you say, he's got every reason to have much higher approval ratings. I do think that that's a function of the fact that he doesn't necessarily hit that message effectively. And you saw that in the reelection bid speech that he gave. It was a bit rambling, a bit. And, you know, he makes the points as he go along, but they are overshadowed by some of these grievance politics and talking about Hillary Clinton's emails. So there's going to have to be a little bit more discipline, if that is a word that can be used within the Trump administration, in getting out that message. One other point I would just like to mention, though, and this is one area of unparalleled success of Trump, and it should have Democrats concerned. He came out of that speech last night having raised almost $25 million in 24 hours. And to put that in perspective, Biden, when he launched, raised about $6 million. So it was four times the amount. Now, he has the ability to do joint fundraising agreements with the Republican National Committee. That is something Democrats cannot do yet. They won't be able to do until they have a nominee. But they had the Republican National Committee, the campaign had $80 million in the bank at the end of March, which is a pretty good position to be starting out with in a race that is undoubtedly going to be very expensive.
I think that the low approval rating suggests that unless the president can get some victories that will raise that, might be a China trade deal, for example, might be passing the new NAFTA through the House, might be some other victory in foreign policy, and maintain a strong economy. The way he's going to have to win re-election, Kyle, is he's going to have to make the Democratic choice, whoever that is, a riskier choice for most voters than he will be. And there will be some risks for a lot of voters, I think, who said the first time around, you know, with Donald Trump, I didn't know what I was getting, but it was worth the risk because Hillary Clinton was worse, and I'm tired of of this of the 8 years after Obama. Now they know Trump. They know he's volatile. They know that they don't like a lot of the things he says from the way he comports himself personally. So the question will be, they'll ask is, do we really want to take a risk on another 4 years? Or is Sanders worse? Or is Warren worse? Or is Biden maybe reassuring and more reassuring?
Right. And one thing to keep in mind is that all of this can change in an instant. I mean, the economy is showing some signs of weakness. We could start, you know, tilting into a recession. North Korea could start, you know, shooting ballistic missiles again or testing, doing some nuclear testing. As long as things keep on the straight and narrow, I think Trump can point to some success. But if things get wobbly, I mean, you can expect whoever the Democratic nominee is to present themselves as a steady hand at the tiller, to talk about how, you know, Trump to call the president erratic, to say that he went from, you know, calling Kim Jong-un little rocket man and talking about fire and fury to talking about how he's getting love letters from the North Korean leader. That's a definite risk. Who knows what the economy or, you know, foreign adversaries will do. But 18 months is a long time for something to happen.
Do you think, Kim, briefly, that Trump is an underdog or the favorite? Or is that an unfair question?
I think that's a totally unfair question this far out of the race. And I refuse to give you an answer that definitive.
All right.
But look, I do think, though, that he has some advantages that he doesn't always get credit for among the traditional media, and that by not acknowledging those, we risk being in the situation we were in 2016 as well, too, where everyone got it wrong.
Well, that's true. The abiding lesson of 2016 for me is humility. It is the voters will always, not always, but in so often will surprise you, particularly in this volatile era of populist political movement. Thank you, Kim Strassel. Thank you, Kyle Peterson. Thank you all for listening. We'll be back later in the week with another edition of Potomac Watch.